From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Trump administration's immigrant family separation brought to light the horrors of the U.S.'s imprisonment of immigrants. But most Americans might be unaware that immigrant detention has a long and sordid history in the United States, going back as far as the late 19th century. Many have challenged the application of the U.S. Constitution to non-citizens, thereby greatly limiting the ability of those incarcerated to advocate for themselves and have any recourse for justice or freedom. Writing about the history of immigrant detention in a new book is Elliot Young. He's a professor in the history department at Lewis and Clark College, the author of Alienation, Chinese Migration in the Americas from the Coolie Era through World War II, and Catarino Garza's Revolution on the Texas-Mexico Border. He's also the co-editor of Continental Crossroads, Remapping U.S.-Mexico Borderlands History, and the co-founder of the Tezpotlan Institute for Transnational History of the Americas. He's also provided expert witness testimony for over 200 asylum cases. He joins me to discuss his new book called Forever Prisoners, How the United States Made the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. Welcome to the program, Elliot.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So the words detention and imprisonment are not the same. We are told in the United States that when immigrants are held behind bars, they're not prisoners, they're not incarcerated, they're simply being detained. They're in the detention system. Is that really accurate? I mean, but for all intents and purposes, from the point of view of the person being detained, they are a prisoner, right?
Exactly. I mean, the law creates these fictions and creates these labels, and it goes stretches back to actually a Supreme Court decision in the late 19th century, 1893, where the Supreme Court decided that to detain, incarcerate an immigrant pending deportation was not imprisonment in the legal sense. And the important distinction here is that if it's not imprisonment in the legal sense, then the person being incarcerated does not have access to the same rights, does not have a judicial trial, and does not have access to a state-mandated lawyer.
So basically due process, which is what everybody who's officially incarcerated, formally incarcerated in the U.S. has.
Exactly. And we know that there are lots of problems with the people who are formally incarcerated in the criminal justice system. But this puts immigrants in an even more vulnerable position where they're not able to use the regular criminal justice system to fight for their rights. And as a result, throughout this 140-year history, many immigrants find themselves facing indefinite detention in these immigrant prisons. And I use that term knowing that it's not the technically right term, but in many cases, the places where immigrants are detained are in fact penitentiaries, they're prisons and jails. So the distinction is really lost on the immigrant.
Now, I recall that when the Bush, the George W. Bush administration, during the so-called War on Terror, began holding enemy combatants, as they were called, in the Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba, that idea of, you know, labeling them as enemy combatants as opposed to prisoners allowed the United States to sidestep those constitutional rights of due process. And of course, we had a whole separate set of justice, military justice, that is still deeply broken for the Guantanamo prisoners. But that wasn't, of course, the first time that the United States incarcerated individuals without giving them rights. So let's go back to the history that you write about in your book. What are the origins of immigrant detention in the United States? How far back do they go?
Yeah, and I think, you know, many people today think about the so-called illegal alien, and it's the Mexican or the Central American. But really, this all starts in the end of the 19th century with the Chinese Exclusion Act, 1882, and with a bureaucracy that develops to try to stop Chinese laborers from coming into the country, and if they are in the country without authorization, to incarcerate and detain them. And so in the 1880s, what was happening is there are a series of pogroms along the Pacific coast in towns like Tacoma and Seattle, and Chinese were literally by mobs of white men, many working class men, pushed out of the towns. They were being then picked up by local police, by marshals, and being sent to this prison on a remote island off the coast of Seattle called McNeil Island Prison. And what initially the authorities tried to do was to just bring them back to Canada, which is where they had come from. But Canada had a head tax for Chinese. And so if the Chinese were unable to pay the head tax, the Canadians refused to accept them. So they ended up back in McNeil Island Prison, piling up for years and years, the government not knowing what to do with them. Eventually in 1890, they started the first deportations all the way back to China. And this begins this process of more than 130 years of detentions and deportations.
So when you say forever prisoners, which is the title of your book, those who become incarcerated under this immigrant detention center that goes back to the late 19th century often don't know when their detention is going to end, right?
Yeah, and you sort of picked up on this inference or invocation of the Guantanamo prisoners, who were labeled by journalists as forever prisoners because many of them don't even have charges. They've not been convicted of anything, and yet they've been now more than two decades incarcerated in Guantanamo. And what you find is that immigrants over various periods find themselves in a very similar position where if they're not able to be deported, they have indeterminate sentences. This is unlike any other person who is in jail or prison. They know, you know, they have a certain number of years they have to serve and then they get out. For these immigrants, they are essentially facing indefinite detention and without the benefits of a judicial trial or the ability to question their liberty. So really, this strikes at the heart of everything that we know to be justice and due process.
So McNeil Island Prison, where Chinese immigrants were held for various infractions, did that, what happened to it? And I understand that eventually it wasn't just Chinese immigrants, it was people from other countries that were held there as well, right?
Exactly. So first of all, it's not just, this was a regular prison, so people were picked up on criminal charges. And what you see happening as we get into the 20th century is increasingly more immigrants are being picked up on drug and alcohol charges. And so this might sort of echo what has been going on with mass incarceration, where there is an increasing policing of drugs in the so-called drug war that leads to mass incarceration. So the same kind of thing was happening in the early 20th century. And by the 1920s and 30s, it's largely Mexicans who are the biggest population of foreigners incarcerated in McNeil Island. So it goes from Chinese to Mexicans.
You highlight in your book the story of Cubans being held at McNeil Island Prison. Tell me that story.
Yeah, so in 1980, the largest boat lift in the history of the United States happened, where 125,000 Cubans fled Cuba to come to the United States. Unlike previous 1950s and 60s, where they had basically declared an end to detaining immigrants who arrived at seaports, in this case, and with the Haitians, who were largely poorer and darker skinned, they set up mass detention camps for them on military bases throughout the country. Many of them were paroled almost all of them were paroled into the United States after a period of time in those mass detention camps. But some of them, before they could legalize their status, had committed low-level infractions, many for simply drug possession. So what happened is they served whatever time they had to serve for that charge, and then they became ineligible for asylum because of that drug charge or because of that criminal infraction. So they were sent directly to Atlanta Penitentiary, where they were being held, some of them, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. What happens is in 1987, the US government negotiates with Cuba to deport 2,000 of these Mariel Cuban refugees who have been sitting in prison pending deportation for years. The Cubans hear about this. They take over Atlanta Penitentiary. They take over a detention center in Oakdale, Louisiana, seize over 100 guards as hostages, torch the buildings, and demand that they have individual reviews of their cases because they actually have legitimate claims to asylum. The standoff ends after 2 weeks. One of the Cuban detainees was actually shot and killed by guards. And they do these individual reviews and end up deporting over 1,000 of them back to Cuba in the early 1990s. But what this episode shows is that by the 1980s, there has been this increasing meshing of immigration law on the one hand and criminal law on the other hand to capture immigrants who had committed, in many cases, low-level infractions and punished them with deportation, or in the case of the Cubans, where they couldn't deport them, with essentially perpetual imprisonment.
And of course, it costs the United States money to keep people in prison for indefinite periods. Before we get to other specifics from your book, as an aside, what do you think has been the prevailing motivation from the United States government? Is it an ideological motivation to send a message? Is it one that reflects the sort of racial oppression that this nation was built on? Is it one of money and corporate interests or private prison interests? What is the motivation to keep people imprisoned, obviously at taxpayer expense, indefinitely?
Yeah, this is a tremendously expensive system. As we know now, immigration enforcement is by far the largest sort of expense in the federal criminal justice system. 70% of prosecutions are against people for entry and illegal entry. So I think it makes no sense from an economic point of view why they're doing this. I think largely it's ideological. It has to do with racism, with the initial reason why immigration restrictions were set up against the Chinese, later against Southern Europeans and Jews, against all Asians, of course, at the beginning of the 20th century, and then increasingly enforcement focused on Mexicans and other Latin Americans. And so I think it's the idea, the racist idea of trying to maintain the purity of a white ethno state. And it's also this sense of preserving the rights of citizens by excluding this group of marginalized others, whether they be Black and Brown citizens or non-citizens who also tend to be Black and Brown.
So it's scapegoating, basically, right?
It's scapegoating, and it serves to, for some people to have this sense of, we have rights as Americans, but our rights need to be defined against the rightlessness of immigrants or these Black and Brown citizens who get incarcerated and increasingly don't have rights. The one point I would want to mention in terms of economic motivation, certainly in terms of immigrant detention, where 2/3 of the immigrant detention centers are run by private corporations, there is an economic interest by those corporations to increasingly detain and incarcerate more and more immigrants. And we see lobbying by groups like GEO, who run the detention centers, to in fact increase enforcement and mandate a certain number of beds per day. And so there is definitely corporate economic interests that benefit and profit off of immigrant detention.
Going back to history and the specific stories you profile in your book, tell me about the story of Nathan Cohen, who you describe as a Russian Jewish Brazilian immigrant. What is his story? It's such a strange story. I'd never really heard of this before.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. So he, Nathan Cohen, comes from a part of Russia that at that point is a borderlands region going back between Germany and Russia. He migrates to Brazil, spends a few years there, then comes to the United States, enters at Ellis Island, joins his family uncle who happens to be in rural Georgia. And he opens a business with his uncle. And this is, you know, up till this point, it's kind of the typical story of like, lucky immigrant comes, opens a business, successful. Within a few months, his family defrauds him out of his business. His wife leaves him for his best friend. This sends him into a funk where he stops speaking, and he ends up being put into a mental hospital, what they called then an insane asylum. And the immigration authorities said, because you've been declared insane, that means you must have been insane when you arrived, and that means you should be deported. So they send him back to New York, put him on a ship, back to Brazil. In Brazil, the Brazilians say, we don't want nothing to do with this guy. We have no relationship with him. They try to land him in Argentina. Argentina refuses to accept him. So he gets sent back to New York, put in Ellis Island, incarcerated on Ellis Island for a few months. The government tries again to deport him. The same thing happens in Brazil. In the meantime, the press picks up on the story and they're referring to him as the wandering Jew, the man without a country. So this time when he comes back to New York Harbor, the government says, don't even let him off the boat, because they realize that once someone is let onto US soil, you actually have more rights than if you're considered to be outside of the country. And so he's essentially stuck on this boat in New York Harbor in this depression, and with the intervention of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid and Sheltering Society and a fraternal organization, they agreed to pay for his upkeep at a private sanitarium in Connecticut. So he gets off the ship, but within a year dies at that sanitarium. He's only in his mid-30s. Wow. And is buried in Staten Island. So it's a very sad case, but what that story pointed me to was discovering that by far the largest number of immigrants and also citizens incarcerated in the 20th century up to about the 1960s were in mental institutions and not in jails and prisons. Only in the latter part of the 20th century that now those mental institutions have shrunk, and basically those same people end up in prisons and jails, which is why you have such a high number of people with mental illness in prisons and jails.
How has the immigration detention system grown in the U.S., and when was its largest period of growth? We know that the George W. Bush administration began detaining whole families that crossed the border. The Obama administration briefly, or to some extent, continued that. And then, of course, under the Trump administration, it exploded and they actually separated parents from children. And today we just have these pretty vast systems of immigrant detention in the United States. So where do you go back to point out the expansion or some sort of rapid expansion of immigrant detention? Or was it just a slow increase over time?
Well, it's more fits and starts. So going, you know, when the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed in 1882, there was no bureaucracy. They had to create a bureaucracy. And over time, you know, more and more funding went into immigration enforcement. But you get various periods where this explodes. In the 1930s, there's a whole so-called repatriation of Mexicans, so they have to beef up enforcement then. 1924, the Border Patrol gets established. 1950s, there's so-called Operation Wetback, where millions of Mexicans are picked up and sent back. So there is these periodic moments when the immigration system gets beefed up and increased. But really, in the last 20 to 30 years, we've seen the massive growth in terms of billions and billions of dollars being spent on enforcement and detention of immigrants. And looking, you know, at the last 20 to 30 years, you could see this is a bipartisan policy. Trump is extreme in his rhetoric, but Trump is in many ways continuing the policies of deportation using the machinery that was built up by Obama. And if you actually look at the numbers of immigrants that Obama deported was far higher than Trump was able to do. And so I think we have to understand that the Democrats have been as responsible for these policies as the Republicans.
And President Joe Biden now has moved to undo some of that damage, I suppose, realizing that what the Democrats did under Obama paved the way for Trump's most egregious anti-immigrant policies. He has pledged to reunite separated families and also moved to try to put a moratorium on deportation, but now we're seeing that a federal court in Texas apparently has blocked his moratorium on deportation. So we'll see how that goes. But moving forward in your book to a more contemporary story, you know, we talked about Nathan Cohen, who you write about, who died, and his story is more than 100 years old. What about the story of Mayra Machado? She is someone who you write about, and you talk about her in an age of crimmigration. What is this word, crimmigration, and who is Mayra Machado?
Yeah, so crimmigration is the overlapping or interlocking of immigration law and criminal law. And so this begins in the 1980s and really picks up in the 1990s under Clinton. And what you see with Mayra Machado's story, she is a Salvadoran who was brought to this country when she was 5 years old in 1990. Her mother was escaping the political violence, the civil war in El Salvador. She grows up as an American, speaking English in Southern California, ends up in Arkansas, and when she's 18 years old, writes a fraudulent check. So clearly committed a mistake, you know, did a mistake, went to court, they sentenced her to 6 months, or they sentenced her to 10 years of stacked charges, but gave her a suspended sentence of 6 months. So she did her time in a diversion program. And that would have been the end of it. That was 2005. What had happened, though, between 2005 and 2015, and especially under Obama, is they deputized local law enforcement to be immigration agents. So in 2015, when she was picked up on a traffic violation, like a failure to yield violation, she gets sent to the police station, and the police officer there is a local deputized ICE officer, runs her immigration information, finds out that she is undocumented and that she has this criminal charge. So she gets sent from Arkansas to Louisiana to ICE detention center and gets put into deportation proceedings. I was contacted at that point by a lawyer to work on her case as an expert witness about country conditions in El Salvador. She loses her struggle and gets deported in early 2017. In El Salvador, is facing sexual harassment, threats by gangs, as well as government officials. So she returns to the United States clandestinely, undocumented again. And after about a year, is picked up on another traffic violation and again gets sent to Louisiana is put into deportation proceedings. But this time, it's illegal reentry, which carries an even greater punishment. So she, from the Louisiana Detention Center, is representing herself. She does not have a lawyer at this point. Calls me up because she had my number when I previously worked on her case and asked if I would serve as an expert witness. And I agreed, got her a pro bono lawyer. We went down to Louisiana to the ICE Detention Center to the hearing. But she eventually loses that. And her case was appealed by the lawyer to the Fifth Circuit Court in 2020 in January, while her case is still pending. One night she's just picked up, shackled, put on a plane, and sent back to El Salvador. And so this case is represents what had happened in the 2000s with this interlocking of criminal law and immigration law that both criminalized migrants and as well as resulting in essentially what amounts to permanent banishment and separation from her three U.S. citizen children who are living still in Arkansas. And so it's a tragic case. She's now living in San Salvador and working to actually reunite children in El Salvador with their parents in the United States.
Well, Elliot, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing information about your book. And I'm sure our audience will pick up copies and read it for themselves. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Elliot Young, a professor in the history department at Lewis and Clark College. We've been discussing his latest book, Forever Prisoners, How the United States Made the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.